Blog Talk Radio.
We must also realize that the problems of racial injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved without a radical redistribution of political and economic power.
We read one day, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if a man doesn't have a job or an income, he has neither life nor liberty and the possibility for the pursuit of happiness. He merely exists.
Estimated that we spend $322,000 for each enemy we kill in Vietnam, while we spend in the so-called war on poverty in America only about $53 for each person classified as poor.
The promises of the Great Society have been shot down on the battlefield of Vietnam, making the poor, white and Negro, bear the heaviest burdens both at the front and at home.
The other thing I want you to understand is this, that it didn't cost the nation one penny to integrate lunch counts. It didn't cost the nation one penny to guarantee the right to vote. But now we are dealing with issues that cannot be solved without the nation spending billions of dollars and undergoing a radical redistribution of economic power.
Yes.
All labor has dignity.
Yes.
And you are doing another thing. You are reminding not only Memphis, but you are reminding the nation that it is a crime for people to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wages.
America's opportunity to help bridge the gulf between the haves and the have-nots. And the question is whether America will do it. There's nothing new about poverty. What is new is that we now have the techniques and the resources to get rid of poverty. And the real question is whether we have the will.
At the very same time that America refused to give the Negro any land, through an act of Congress, our government was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that it was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor. But not only did they give the land, they built land-grant colleges with government money to teach them how to farm. Not only that, they provided county agents to further their expertise in farming. Not only that, they provided low interest rates in order that they could mechanize their farms. Not only that, today many of these people are receiving millions of dollars in federal subsidies not to farm, and they are the very people telling the black man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. Now, this is what we are faced with, and this is the reality. Now, when we come to Washington in this campaign, we are coming to get our check.
I come here tonight and plead with you. Believe in yourself and believe that you're somebody. As I said to the group last night, nobody else can do this for us. No document can do this for us.
No Lincolnian Emancipation Proclamation can do this for us. No Kennisonian or Johnsonian Civil Rights Bill can do this for us. If the Negro is to be free, he must move down into the inner resources of his own soul and sign with the pen and ink of self-assertive manhood his own Emancipation Proclamation. Don't let anybody take your manhood. Be proud of our heritage. As somebody said earlier tonight, we don't have anything to be ashamed of. Somebody told a lie one day. They couched it in language. They made everything black, ugly, and evil. Look in your dictionary and see the synonyms of the word black. It's always something degrading and low and sinister. Look at the word white. It's always something pure, high, and clean. But I want to get the language right tonight. I want to get the language so right that everybody here will cry out, yes, I'm black, I'm proud of it, I'm black and beautiful.
What is the relationship between this and the reality of the Negro masses?
Well, to move out of it for a moment.
There's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love and kiss here today. Picket lines and picket signs, don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see. Oh, what's going on? What's going on? Yeah, what's going on? Oh, what's going on?
Right on.
Simply cause our hair is long. Oh, you know we've got to find a way. Bring some understanding here today. Oh, oh, oh. Pick it back and pick it back. Don't punish me for brutality. Come on, talk to me. You can see what's going on. Yeah, what's going on? Tell me what's going on. I'll tell you what's going on. Ooh.
they used to be now. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east. Oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be now.
King movement tonight, and things ain't what they used to be. The mass murders all over the city of Chicago, and look like can't nobody, somebody ask what's going on. It's going on that we need to understand that there's too many guns in the hands of children. 11-year-old boy hijacked 5 cars. Where is his parents? Where's mama, daddy at? So we got so many young folks out here with guns. And they don't know what to do. So it's dangerous. And ain't nobody saying nothing about it. The preachers need to be talking. The preachers, the deacons, and every church member, the bishop need to be talking, getting involved. Police can't do it alone, because when the police get there, the shooting is over with. Shooting on the Dan Ryan. Shooting in the stores. Uncontrolling people. Black on black, brown on brown. This is some of the stuff happening as I speak tonight. And this is what Dr. King said.
We must also realize that the problems of racial injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved without a radical redistribution of political and economic power.
We read one day, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if a man doesn't have a job or an income, he has neither life nor liberty.
And Dr. King himself, boy and girl, he said, man. And these young boys got guns, they're sticking up in the grocery stores because they got so many guns, they don't know what to do with them. I'm praying tonight, and as we talk about Dr. King, this is the Dr. King movement. Where we go from him? Community of care. What do you do? You got a 11 and a 12-year-old running in the streets with a gun, hijacking grown people. Where's the daddies? Where's the mama? And the mamas, where is the mama? The kids run around with guns. Where do kids go? I mean, do you go to their room? They don't go to school. So it's a loss going on. There's a loss of killing and murder going on. A loss of unnecessary stuff. Until the men step up, until the bishops, until these pastors, the imam and the pope, and all the people that will step up and say enough is enough. The police can't solve it. It's the people in the community can solve it. We need community policing. We need to those and when they go to jail, they need to stay in jail. And with so much killing going on, we might have to bring back the death penalty in order to stop some of this, just killing for nothing. Then we're in the midst of the virus. We're in the midst of people getting jobs. So we got a whole lot on our plate.
We must also realize that the problems of racial injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved without a radical redistribution of political and economic power.
We read one day, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if a man doesn't have a job or an income, he has neither life nor liberty and the possibility for the pursuit of happiness. He merely exists.
Estimated that we spend $322,000.
Now, what I want to say tonight, lots of people looking for jobs. I'm going to, my book coming out, Prophecy for 2022. I prophesied 2022, lots of people going to come together. Be sure to get my book, The Prophecy, by The Prophecy of 2022. Now, some of you need jobs. I'm going to decree your job. You need to plant a seed in our ministry. Go to the seed of Abraham, website.com. Go down to the home page and get PayPal and give me some. I want to do that, but I'm going to do it for you anyway. I'm going to play a little bit. I'm going to get back to Dr. King.
What's your thinking? Why could be in war with richness? Or a comparison American website has some very interesting answers. Ever seen this man? No? Well, you're not alone. But what if he told you he is the richest human being ever in all of recorded human history? And his fortune? Wait for it. $400 billion. Yes, you heard that right. This is Mansa Musa the First. Mansa, who lived in the 1300s and ruled West Africa's Mali, dots the list of 25 richest people of all time, brought up by the Celebrity Network website. The list uses the annual 2,199.6% rate of inflation to adjust historic fortunes. This means that $100 million in 1930 would be equal to roughly 3.7.
I want to make sure I send you the financial covenant of Master Musa, the richest black man in the world. Let me say that again. The richest black man in the world. Nobody's never been richer than Master Musa. He's the most richest black man. And he was an African, and he was a Muslim. But I got the financial covenant him for you, and I want you to read. I'm going to give you a few scriptures. Revelation 22:1, Proverbs 4:22, St. Matthew 6:33, Proverbs 13:22, Genesis 3:2-3, Master Musa. And I want you to receive the financial covenant from God. And I want you to be able to read this and implement what's going to be. You want some money, you want a job, you need to know the people that can bless you. If you got to meet, you plant a seed and let God bless you.
$1 billion today. Interestingly, the list, which is meant to comprise the top 25 richest people of all time, lists the top 26. The 26th being American Warren Buffett, with a net worth of $64 billion. But there's some interesting highlights in the list. Firstly, there are no women on the list. 14 out of the top 25 are American nationals. All the people on the list are either aristocrats or kings. Carlos Slim, the current richest person in the world, isn't even in the top 20, coming in at 22nd place with $68 million. There is, however, an Indian presence on the list, with Mir Osman Ali Khan, the last ruler of Hyderabad, who died in 1967, coming in at 6th spot, with a fortune of $236 million. One can only hope, though, that is not the last time ever an Indian figure in the list. Bureau report.
Now, what I'm saying tonight, some of you need a breakthrough. You need a financial breakthrough. And you're saying you ain't got to steal it. A lot of people steal, a lot of Europeans stole your ideas. Our ancestors stole the whole lot. But I want tonight, I want you to be able to listen to where we come from. Out of racism, white supremacy. We all come from that. I want to say to you tonight, I want to decree the job for you. You know, you said, but well, Bishop, people ain't working now. We're not going to do no slave work no more. I prophesied in 2022, if a company making a $1 trillion company, you got to pay the employee $150,000 a year. It's too much of money been stolen from black folks. Let me say this. The Dr. King movement, the Marcus Garvey movement, the Malcolm X movement, Malcolm X was killed. Marcus Garvey run out of the country. Malcolm was killed. Dr. King was killed. What about no dream? About economic development is about the money, and it's still about the money. And young folks are saying, we're not working for no minimum wage. We need a living wage. And if you ain't talking about, well, we're going to go to college. Let me go to college. I've been to college, got degrees, and you still ain't got no job. We got to take what's out. And what I mean by that, you got to go in business, set your own business up. And we got to support. Ain't nothing in the black community but the funeral home. They don't want making the money. The rest of them, they got the Arabs in there. They got the Indians. Got everybody there but black. Walmart and all them other folks, they're making money. Where is the money for our ancestors? We never did get the reparation. I know y'all. Yeah, it belongs to your ancestors. If your great-grandmother worked in the cotton field, and made cotton king in Mississippi, and went to Virginia and made the tobacco king, went to Louisiana and made sugar cane king. Where is the money? We never did get reparation. The Indians got, everybody got reparation but us. And that's what Dr. King was talking about. Everybody got money but the black man.
We must also realize that the problems of racial injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved without a radical redistribution of political and economic power.
We read one day, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if a man doesn't have a job or an income, he has neither life nor liberty and the possibility for the pursuit of happiness. He merely exists. Estimated that we spend $322,000 for each enemy we kill in Vietnam, while we spend in the so-called war on poverty in America only about $53 for each person classified as poor. The promises of the Great Society have been shot down on the battlefield of Vietnam, making the poor, white and Negro, bear the heaviest burdens both at the front and at home.
The other thing I want you to understand is this. And it didn't cost the nation one penny to integrate lunch counts. It didn't cost the nation one penny to guarantee the right to vote. But now we are dealing with issues that cannot be solved without the nation spending billions of dollars and undergoing a radical redistribution of economic power. Yes.
All labor has dignity.
Yes.
But you are doing another thing. You are reminding not only Memphis, but you are reminding the nation that it is a crime for people to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wages. America's opportunity to help bridge the gulf between the haves and the have-nots. And the question is whether America will do it. There's nothing new about poverty. What is new is that we now have the techniques and the resources to get rid of poverty. And the real question is whether we have the will.
At the very same time that America refused to give the Negro any land,
through an act of Congress, our government was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that it was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor. But not only did they give the land, they built land-grant colleges with government money to teach them how to farm. Not only that, they provided county agents to further their expertise in farming. Not only that, they provided low interest rates in order that they could mechanize their farms. Not only that, today many of these people are receiving millions of dollars in federal subsidies not to farm, and they are the very people telling the black man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. Now, this is what we are faced with, and this is the reality. Now, when we come to Washington in this campaign, we are coming to get our check. I come here.
Dr. King. Dr. King told the truth that it's already blown to us. And you waiting on somebody to give you a job, you got to create your own job. You got to create your own situation. We've been waiting too long. And everybody else that came over, we was already him. They brought us from Africa and changed. They never did give the black man and the black woman what we told us. So now it's time for us to stand up and open our eyes. I'm praying tonight.
Open eyes that we may last year to vote for
civil rights legislation because it dealt with an issue applicable to the North, the whole housing cluster. And this, it seems to me, was the greatest expression of the hypocrisy of many of our citizens, many of the senators, congressmen of the North. But isn't that part of the dilemma now? People knew the Negroes were being denied what was guaranteed by the Constitution, by the fact that they were citizens of this country. Then when they were given those rights, you feel the white community said, well, we've given them all that we have. Now it's up to them.
Well, I think the dilemma is much deeper, and I think one during this period transition has to be very honest with America. And honesty tells you to admit that America has more racist elements still alive, racism is still existing in American society in many areas, society, north and south. And the other thing is that there has never been a single, solid, determined commitment of large segments of white America on the whole question of racial equality. I think we have to believe that vacillation has always existed, ambivalence has always existed. This to me is the so-called white backlash. Merely a new name for an old phenomenon. I see the white backlash as a continuation of the same ambivalence and vacillation of white America, the whole presentation of justice that has existed since the founding of our nation. I think the other thing that we must see at this time is that many of the people who supported us in Selma, Birmingham, were really outraged about the extremist behavior toward people. But they were not at that moment, and they are not now, committed to genuine equality for people. It's much easier to integrate a lunch counter than it is to guarantee an annual income, for instance, to get rid of poverty for Negroes. It's much easier to integrate a bus than it is to make genuine integration of reality and quality education a reality in our school. It's much easier to integrate even a public power than it is to get rid of slums. And I think we are in a new era, a new phase, where we have moved from a struggle for decency, which characterized our struggle 10 or 12 years, to a struggle for genuine equality. And this is where we get resistance, because there was never any intention to go this far. People were reacting to Bull Connor and to Jim Carr rather than acting in good faith for the realization of genuine equality.
Do you think white people in this country, and I'm talking about non-segregation, as people devoid, thinking they're devoid of racism, do you have any idea of what they want the Negro to be in America?
Well, it depends on the level that you're talking here, because I think you have to make a distinction between the people who are genuinely and absolutely committed to the white community on the question of racial equality. And I must confess that I think they are a very small minority. I think the vast majority of white Americans will go but so far as a kind of installment plan for equality. And they are always looking for an excuse to go but so far.
Why are they looking for the excuse? What is it about the Negro and every other group that came as immigrants somehow, not easily, but somehow got around it? Is it just the fact the Negroes are black?
That's a part of it, and growing, that grows out of something else. You can't thingify anything without depersonalizing that something. If you use something as a means to an end, at that moment, make the thing and depersonalize. The fact is that the Negro was a slave in this country 244 years. That act, that was a willful thing that was done. The Negro was brought in, changed, treated in very human fashion. And this led to the thingification. So he was not looked upon as a person. He was not looked upon as a human being with the same status and worthiness of a human being. And the other thing is human beings cannot continue to do wrong without eventually rationalizing that wrong. So slavery was justified morally, biologically, theoretically, scientifically, everything else. And it seems to me that white America must see that no other ethnic group has been a slave on American soil. That is one thing that other immigrant groups have had to face. The other thing is that the color became a stigma. American society made the Negro's color a stigma. And that can never be overlooked. So I think these things are absolutely necessary. The other thing is that America freed the slaves in 1863. That's based on the proclamation of Abraham Lincoln, but gave the slaves no land or nothing in reality, as a matter of fact, to get started on. At the same time, America was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that there was a willingness to give the white peasants from Europe an economic base. And yet it refused to give its black peasants from Africa, who came here involuntarily in chains and had worked free for 244 years, any kind of economic basis. So emancipation for the Negro was really freedom to hunger. It was freedom to the winds and rains of heaven. It was freedom without food to eat or land to cultivate. And that was freedom and famine at the same time. And when white Americans tell the Negro to lift himself by his own bootstraps, they don't look over the legacy of slavery and segregation. I believe we ought to do all we can and seek to lift ourselves by our bootstraps. But it's a cruel jest to say to the bootless man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. And many Negroes, about thousands of millions, have been left bootless as a result of all of the oppression and as a result of a society that deliberately made its color a stigma and something worth great. Apart from wanting to live better, which all of us want to do, to raise one's children in a better way, to be better, does the Negro in America know what he wants to be? Almost every Negro in this country, other than those who have been so scarred by the system, has become pathological in the process, and we all have to battle the pathology. Nobody really knows. To be it, the best one can really experience. And I know we all have battled with this constant train of feeling of nobody. But in spite of this, I think the vast majority of Negroes in this country know that they want to be people. They want to be men. They want equality, period. That boils down to that. And we haven't been able to be people. We haven't been men because of all of the conditions that we live with and the syndrome of deprivation surrounding conditions, whether it's in housing or in the economic area or in schools or vicious credit practices in the ghetto, and all of the problems that close doors constantly beat. But in spite of all this, I think we all know basically that we want to be men, want to be persons judged not on the basis of the color of our skin, but on the basis of the content of our character.
You know, many young Negroes don't want anything that smacks the American white middle class. But do they want something that smacks of whatever is the black middle class? Or do they just not want bourgeois values, which after all are the basis of this democracy?
Well, I think we have to see what they are saying. I would be the first to agree that integration does not mean giving up everything that has an Afro-American taint, so to speak, a background. I think there are certain unique things within any culture and certain cultural patterns get to the process of amalgamation can really live the whole culture. It seems to me that integration at its best is the opportunity to participate in the beauty of diversity. I think the other thing guts is that these young people are saying that there must be a revolution of values in our country. As Jimmy Baldwin said on one occasion, what advantage is there in integrated into providing housing? And I think all that values a need for a revolution of values in America. Because some of the values at present are certainly out of line with the values and the idealistic structure that brought our nation into being. Unfortunately, we haven't been true to these ideals. And many of the values of so-called white middle-class society are values that need to be reviewed and re-evaluated, and in a real sense, they need to be changed. So I think the young people in the Negro community who are raising these questions are raising some very profound questions about our total society. In other words, they are saying that there must be a restructuring of the architecture of our society where values are concerned. And with this, I would agree with. So in the quest for integration, I think we can offer our whole nation something, because there are three evils in our nation. It's not only racism, but economic exploitation of poverty would be one, and then militarism. And I think in a sense, and in a very real sense, these three are tied inextricably together, and we aren't going to get rid of one without getting rid of the other.
When you stood on the Lincoln Memorial that day in August 63, you said, "I had a dream." Did that dream envision that you could see a war in Asia preventing the federal government doing for the Negroes, preventing the society doing for the Negroes? That which you
heard a little song.
I must confess that period was a great period of hope for me. And I'm sure for many others all across the nation, many of the Negroes who had about lost hope, saw a solid decade of progress in the South. And in 1954, which was, 64, 1963, 9 years after the Supreme Court's decision to begin the March on Washington, meant a great deal. It was a high moment, a great watershed moment. But I must confess that that dream that I had that day has in many points turned into a nightmare. Now, I'm not one to lose hope. I keep on hoping. I still have faith in the future. But I've had to analyze many things over the last few years, and I would say over the last few months. I've gone through a lot of soul searching and agonizing moments. And I've come to see that we have many more difficult days ahead, and some of the old optimism was a little superficial, and now it must be tempered with a solid realism. And I think the realistic fact is that we still have a long, long way to go, and that we are involved in a war on Asian soil, which, if not checked and stopped, can poison the very soul of our nation.
Dr. King, even if there had not been a war in Asia, would you still not have had this nightmare insofar as the Negro movement for equality then touched on two things that the white community holds sacred, their children and their property?
Oh, I have no doubt that we would have encountered great difficulties, great problems of resistance if the war had not been in existence, so that I'm not going to say that all of our problems will be solved if the war in Vietnam is ended. But I do say that the war makes it infinitely more difficult to deal with these problems. When a nation becomes obsessed with the guns of war, it loses its social perspective, and programs of social uplift suffer. This is just a fact of history, so that we do face many more difficulties as a result of the war. It's much more difficult to really arouse a conscience during the time of war. I noticed the other day, some weeks ago, a Negro was shot down in Chicago, and it was a clear case of police brutality. That was on page 30 of the paper, but on page 1 at the top was 780 Viet Cong killed. That is something about a war like this that makes people insensitive. It dulls the conscience. It strengthens the forces of reaction, and it brings into being bitterness, hatred, and violence, and it strengthened the military-industrial complex for our country, and it's made our job much more difficult, because I think we can go along with some programs, if we didn't have this war on our hands, that would cause people to adjust to new developments, just as they did in the South. They said they'd never ride the bus with us, blood would flow in the streets, they wouldn't go to school, and all of these things. But when people came to see that they had to do it because the law insisted, they finally adjusted. And I think white people all over this country will adjust once the nation makes it clear that in schools and housing, we've got to learn to live together as brothers. I think the biggest problem now is that we got our gains over the last 12 years at bargain rate, so to speak. It didn't cost the nation. In fact, it helped the economic side of the nation, the integrated lunch counters and public accommodation. It didn't cost the nation anything to get the right to vote established. Now we are confronting issues that cannot be solved without costing the nation billions of dollars. Now, I think this is where we're getting our greatest resistance. They may put it on many other things, but we can't get rid of slums and poverty without it costing the nation something.
There's a little song that we sing in our movement down in the South. I don't know if you've heard it, but it has become the theme song. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. Deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome. Though I join hands so often with students and others behind jail bars singing it, we shall overcome. Sometimes we've had tears in our eyes when we joined together to sing it, but we still decided to sing it, we shall overcome. No, before this victory's won, some will have to get thrown in jail some more, but we shall overcome. Don't worry about us. Before the victory's won, some of us will lose jobs, but we shall overcome. Before the victory's won, even some will have to face physical death. But if physical death is the price that some must pay to free their children from a permanent psychological death, then nothing shall be more redemptive. We shall overcome. Before the victory's won, some would be misunderstood and called bad names and dismissed as rabble-rousers and agitators. But we shall overcome. And I tell you why. We shall overcome because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. We shall overcome because Carlyle is right. No lie can live forever. We shall overcome.
No lie can live forever, and that's true. Now, I want to take this right now, this time to say it to you tonight that are listening. You know, they went, they lit the menorah. They lit the candles, but the light, the really light, Psalms 27, the light, my salvation, God got the light in you, man. They can light all the candles they want to. The truth got to come out. And I want to say, along with Dr. King, along with Marcus Garvey, Sojourner Truth, Henry McNeil Turner, that we shall overcome with some of your ancestors, some of you that are listening tonight, some of your ancestors. We got brothers in the jail. I've been asking to free the political prisoners. 2020, we was going through something. It's 21, we still is not dealt with the economic development of people. It's, one lady told me, I'm not going to work for no $4 an hour. I'm not going to work for $10 an hour and my company making trillions of dollars. Unless you come to the table, we got to deal with rights. We got to deal with rights. People need a living wage. Doctors, lawyers, you need a living wage. So you got people is not going to work And it ain't because they're getting money from the welfare, they're getting money from social. They said, if my ancestor can get nothing, and I've been working here, and people come from Europe, people come from all over and get a job. One of the things I want to say tonight, over in Afghanistan, that was $6 trillion spent over there when they went to get Bin Laden. $6 trillion. They brought half these people back here. What happened to the $6 trillion in 20 years that was spent over there? They built houses. They left guns. They left airplanes. They left helicopters over there. For what? For those people. So what I'm saying, we shall overcome. And you say, well, I didn't like the light. You ain't got to like the light. The light of God is in you, man. The light of God is in you, woman. And with all that's going on, God is still in control.
There's a little song that we sing in our movement down in the South. I don't know if you've heard it, but it has become the theme song. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. Deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome. Though I join hands so often with students and others behind jail bars singing it, we shall overcome. Sometimes we've had tears in our eyes when we join together to sing it, but we still decided to sing it. We shall overcome. No, before this victory is won, some will have to get thrown in jail some more, but we shall overcome. Don't worry about us. Before the victory is won, some of us will lose jobs, but we shall overcome. Before the victory is won, even some will have to face physical death. But if physical death is the price that some must pay to free their children from a permanent psychological death, then nothing shall be more redemptive. We shall overcome. Before the victory is won, some would be misunderstood and called bad names and dismissed as rabble-rousers and agitators. But we shall overcome. And I tell you why. We shall overcome because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. We shall overcome because Carlyle is right. No lie can live forever. We shall overcome because William Cullen Bryant is right. Truth crushed to earth will rise again. We shall overcome because James Russell Lowell is right. Truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne. Yet that scaffold sways the future. Behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. We shall overcome because the Bible is right. You shall reap what you sow. We shall overcome. Deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome. And with this faith, we will go out and adjourn the councils of despair and bring new light into the dark chambers of pessimism. And we will be able to rise from the fatigue of despair to the buoyancy of hope. And this will be a great America. We will be the participants in making it so. And so as I leave you this evening, I say, walk together, children. Don't you get weary. There's a great camp meeting in the palace.
To understand this, you have to go back to what young brother here referred to as the house Negro and the field Negro back during slavery. There was two kinds of slaves. There was the house Negro and the field Negro. The house Negro, they lived in the house with master. They dressed pretty good. They ate good because they ate his food because he left. They lived in the attic or the basement, but still they lived near their master. And they loved their master more than the master loved himself. They would give their life to save their master's house quicker than the master would. The house Negro, if the master said, we got a good house here, the house Negro said, yeah, we got a good house here. Whenever the master said we, he said we. That's how you can tell a house Negro. If the master's house caught on fire, the house Negro would fight harder to put the blaze out than the master would. If the master got sick, the house Negro would say, what's the matter, boss? We sick. We sick. identified himself with his master more than his master identified with himself. And if you came to the house, Negro, and said, let's run away, let's escape, let's separate, that house Negro would look at you and say, man, you crazy. What you mean separate? Where is there a better house than this? Where can I wear better clothes than this? Where can I eat better food than this? That was that house Negro. In those days he was called a house nigger. And that's what we call him today, because we still got some house niggers running around here. This modern house Negro loves his master. He wants to live near him. He'll pay three times as much as the house is worth just to live near his master. And then brag about, I'm the only Negro out here. I'm the only one on my job. I'm the only one in this school, you nothing but a house Negro. And if someone come to you right now and say, let's separate, you say the same thing that the house Negro said on the plantation. What you mean separate? From America? This good white man? Where you gonna get a better job than you get here? I mean, this is what you say. I ain't left nothing in Africa. That's what you say. Why, you left your mind in Africa. On that same plantation, there was the field Negro. The field Negro, those were the masses. There was always more Negroes in the field then there was Negroes in the house. The Negro in the field caught hell. He ate leftovers. In the house, they ate high up on the hog. The Negro in the field didn't get nothing but what was left of the insides of the hog. They call them chitlins nowadays. In those days, they call them what they were, guts. That's what you were, a gut eater. And some of you are still gut eaters. The field Negro was beaten from morning till night. He lived in a shack, in a hut. He wore cast-off clothes. And he hated his master. I say he hated his master. He was intelligent. That house Negro loved his master. But that field Negro, remember, they were in the majority. And they hated the master. When the house caught on fire, he didn't try and put it out. That field Negro prayed for a wind, for a breeze. When the master got sick, the field Negro prayed that he died. If someone come to the field Negro and said, let's separate, let's run, he didn't say, where are we going? He said, any place is better than here. You got field Negroes in America today. I'm a field Negro. The masses are the field Negroes. When they see this man's house on fire, you don't hear these little Negroes talking about our government is in trouble. They say the government is in trouble. Imagine a Negro, our government. I even heard one say, our astronauts. They won't even let him near the plant.